Several months ago, Bruce Schuetz, our musical director, came to me and said that he felt it would be a nice way to signal Jewish Music Month if we were to play at one of these Sunday services some of the music of Salomone Rossi. And so we have done. The instrumental music which began our worship, the setting for a stanza from the 80th Psalm, which was its opening anthem, the call to prayer, the Boruch Hu, the may the words of my mouth, Yi Leratzon, which introduced the silent prayer, and finally this lovely setting of the 121st Psalm are all by the hand of that late 16th, early 17th century Italian Jewish composer. And there will be one other melody of his, which you will hear at the end of the service. It's interesting music. In its way, it's traditional music, though we're not accustomed to it. And I thought what I would do this morning is to tell you of some of my own discoveries as I began to research Rossi and to prepare what might be called program notes for this morning. Rossi was born in 1570 in a town called Mantua in Italy. He died in 60 years later in the same town. His period is called by the historians the Catholic Counter-Reformation. It's a time of stern reaction within the Roman Catholic Church, which is concerned with the strength and the appeal of the new Lutheran and Protestant heresies, and which at least acknowledges or is beginning to acknowledge some of the worldliness, the simony, the sale of indulgences, some of the excesses which had accreted to the church during the Renaissance. The Renaissance, which was a period, as you know, of a great efflorescence, a great flowering of Western civilization, was over by the middle of the 16th century. But in Mantua, at the court of the Dukes of Gonzaga, where Rossi was lived and by whom he was hired, there was an afterglow. In many ways, Rossi's life is best understood within the terms of the Renaissance period itself. And the Renaissance, of course, means the renaissance, the rebirth of classical learning. It's a time of the development of a philosophic humanism, which we associate with Erasmus and Reuchlin and men of that caliber. It's a great era in the flowering of Western painting, Raphael and Michelangelo and Leonardo. In music, it's the development of intricate harmonies. Music, the development of truly composed music associated with Palestrina and Monteverdi and others. It's a time of the rebirth of Western civilization, really, after the Dark Ages, after the feudal period. Now, there's a kind of rule of the thumb in European history that the more worldly the church, the more interested the church is in the arts. And there's also another rule of European history, it's my own invention, that the more worldly the church, the better off it is for Jews. The Renaissance was not a period which was the best of all times, but in Italy, it was a period in which worldly churchmen interested in enlarging and rebuilding the Vatican, interested in sponsoring and patronizing men of literature and of the arts, interested in the hunt and in war and in all of the traditional affairs of Italian statesmen. It was a period in which, for the most part, they were willing to turn their backs a bit, at least turn their heads away from the demands of the stricter churchmen, to impose the rigidity of the church's apartheid laws against the Jews. Now, to be sure, it was a period when Franciscan monks were going up and down the peninsula of Italy, preaching against the Jews, damning us for being people of commerce, being bankers and money lenders who were providing the risk capital which was allowing the city-states of Italy to flourish, condemning the Jews as deicides, Christ killers. It was these Franciscan monks who first popularized the blood libel, the canard that Jews required the blood of a young Christian child for the proper observance of the Seder. And if you read the legal literature, the responsa written by the Italian rabbis of the time, you'll find them encouraging homeowners to serve white wine at Seder. Red wine could be confused with blood and might lead to some suspicion that, in fact, these charges being promulgated by churchmen were, in fact, true. But by and large, the Medicis and D'Estes and the Sforzas and the Gonzagas, the other great dukes and leaders who headed the Italian states, and the popes themselves, were willing to allow Jews some measure of opportunity, particularly if the Jew were bright and able, and particularly if he was involved in one of three areas. If he were a banker, if he were a physician, or if he were a musician. They required Jewish bankers because church law forbade the putting out of money on interest, and without risk capital, there cannot be the development of commerce, trade, the founding of new industries. And this was a period in which there was great opportunity. Physicians, the Jewish physicians at the time were superior to those among in the non-Jewish world because the Jews had brought over from the Arab world the great medical knowledge of Greece and of the Arab world, knowledge largely lacking to their Christian counterparts. And finally, musicians, for the same reason that the great capitals of Europe imported the musicians of the shtetl to play on the concert stage in the 19th and 20th century. Talent is not distributed by religion. And whereas Jews were largely precluded from the plastic arts because the great painters had studios which were essentially places where you were apprenticed, and the articles of apprenticeship required a religious conformity. But in the musical world, the world of the virtuoso, in the musical world, talent will out. And because these great families wanted to have the best musicians, they vied with each other in musical competition and having at their courts the flower of Italian civilization. Whenever a Jew showed great musical talent, talent as a voice, talent as an instrumentalist, talent as a composer, talent as a dance master, he was often invited to the court and given special privilege. He was applauded, if not approved. Now, Rossi comes from a family which apparently, as some families are, had musical genes. We know very little of his biography. We do know he had a sister who was an operatic diva. She went by the stage name of Madame Europa. I'd like to know what her Hebrew name was. And her children and grandchildren were all musicians of some note. What does a rabbi do when he wants to learn more about a musician? He listens to the music, but he also sees if he can find a copy of whatever music this man wrote for the synagogue. And doing some research, I discovered that the first book of compositions from which all of the liturgical music that you heard was taken by Salomone Rossi was published in 1622 in Venice. It's a Hebrew text published by a house called Barzini, interestingly, a non-Jewish publishing house. You know, if you go back into Jewish history, you find a lot of anomalies. And one of these is that most of the early Hebrew publishing was done by non-Jews. Why? Not that Jews could not have cut the type, but that presses and type were expensive and Jewish life was insecure, and often one who started out as a Jewish printer was able to print one or two books, and then the mob would come and ransack and destroy his plant, and he would be out of business. And this, of course, the non-Jewish printers was a danger they did not face. And they quickly discovered what printers and publishers have known ever since, that we are a book-consuming public. The title of the book, Ashirim Asher Lishlomo, the songs which belong to Solomon. It is three-fourths of the opening line of the biblical scroll, the Song of Songs, Shir Hashirim Asher Lishlomo. It was obviously taken because these are songs, and because his name was Solomon. It is not to suggest that any of the settings are settings for the poems from the Song of Songs. They are not. They are mostly from the Psalms. But in any case, it was a way of establishing his copyright, his name, on all the material that bore that was within the book. And then when I turned to the second page, and of course, being a Hebrew book, it's one of the few books of musical compositions which runs from right to left instead of from left to right, I found not the musical score as I had expected, nor did I find myself face to face with some explanation by the composer, but I found myself in my own world, in the rabbinic world. I found that I was reading what we call a rabbinic responsa, a bit of legal rabbinic literature which has to do with someone asking the rabbi for a decision in a particular case, and the rabbi responding as to what his opinion was as to how the case should be, or the issue should be resolved. And I quickly leafed through the responsa to see who had signed it, and it had been signed by a rabbi named Yehuda Aryeh ben Yitzchak. Now immediately you're thinking of a bearded man, an elderly scholar, bent from years of study over the sacred lore, black-suited, maybe black-robed. And that's the image that most of us have about medieval rabbis. But I don't know anyone better than Yaakov Aryeh ben... Where am I? Of Yaakov Aryeh ben Yitzchak to destroy that image for us. He had an Italian name, this rabbi, Leon de Modena. And Leon de Modena has left us, all of his rabbinic literature, an interesting little autobiography, something rare among the rabbis of the time. And what we find is a man whose life, I think, will destroy once and for all this stereotype for you. He was born not of a poor family, but he was born of a very wealthy family in Venice a year after Salomone Rosse, 1571. He would die in Venice in 1648. His father was a wealthy man who had inherited his wealth from his grandfather, a physician, who had been the court physician of the Holy Roman Empire, Emperor Charles V, and who had been knighted for his service, so that his grandfather was, in fact, a knight of the Golden Fleece of the Holy Roman Empire, one of the great honors which could come to a man in that day. So Leon de Modena, Yehuda Aryeh, was in fact a child of wealth. He was a child of privilege. He was a Jew. He was also an Ilui, a young man with an unusual brain who showed his genius quite early. At the age of 2, he tells us that he was able to read in the synagogue the prophetic portion of the week. At the age of 3 1/2, he appeared in the synagogue and gave a line-by-line interpretation of the Torah portion of the week. I suppose they had to build up a series of boxes for him so he could be above the pulpit. But here he was, squeaking away in his little soprano with a very intelligent conversation about the Torah portion of the week. His father provided him with tutors in all the classic humanist and Renaissance studies, as well as, of course, in Torah and in Talmud. He wore the garment of upper-class Venetians. His family had been specifically excluded from the requirement of wearing the Jew badge or Jew clothes. We're told he was something of a soccer player. At the age of 12, he produced a very fine metrical translation into Hebrew of the first several cantos of the most celebrated and difficult extended poetic epic of the day, Ariosto's Orlando Furioso. And at the age of 13, he wrote the first of a number of popular moralistic studies, a study in which called Sur Min Hara, Turn Away from Evil, in which he inveighed against the evils of gambling. Now, what's interesting about Sur Min Hara is not only that it's a discussion between an inveterate gambler and a wise old man who cautions the gambler about his problems, but that the gambler is a man who's intrigued not only by the contest, the competition, by pitting his mind against the minds of others, but he's also intrigued by the mathematical challenge involved in gambling. And gambling, incidentally, was the Jewish vice of the Middle Ages. In any case, all of his life, Leon de Modena, Yudarya, failed to listen to his own good advice. He was a passionate gambler. He was a terrible gambler. He was a gambler anytime he had money, and sometimes when he didn't have money, he was at the card tables. His father lost his wealth in some business undertakings when he was an adolescent, and all the rest of his life he had somehow to scramble for a living. Whenever he had a few ducats in his pocket, back he was at the card tables. Unfortunately, several times when the community gave him funds for one purpose or another, one charitable purpose or another, he gambled these away at the card tables. And interestingly, like all gamblers, he was unwilling to admit that the fault was his own. All through the autobiography, he keeps saying, the planets cursed me. It's all the fault of the stars. It's not mine. And because of his chronic need for money, he lists in his autobiography 26 different occupations which he undertook in order to earn a living, to support his family. I'm not sure I can name all of them, but here are a number of them. At one time or another, he tutored Jewish children, and he tutored Christian children. He taught people calligraphy, the art of fine writing. He acted as a public scribe, simply writing private letters for people. He drew up contracts for businessmen. He was a preacher of note. He ghost-wrote sermons for other preachers. He was a rabbi. He was dayan. He was a paid official of the rabbinic courts. He acted as a cantor, a chazan in the synagogue. He was a marriage broker. He took finder's fees for arranging business contracts. He earned royalties by the publication of his books. He wrote amulets and charms for people who wanted Kabbalistic protection. He wrote sonnets. He organized the choir for the Dukes of Gonzaga. He wrote comedies. He wrote Italian sonnets. He was the music director for plays at the court. He was the director of a number of stage productions for the court. And to top it all off, he was a professional marriage broker, a shadchan. Now, to give you a further sense of Yehuda Aryeh's life, let me tell you about his family. He had three sons. The eldest died when he was 26 years of age of lead poisoning. He was an alchemist, and he tried some of his own potions. The second of his sons was a young man about town who prided himself on being a swordsman. Got in a number of duels, and in one of the duels, his luck ran out. The third son was a ne'er-do-well who ran off, of all places, to Brazil and was never heard from since. Now, remember, this is the year 1600, and you don't run off to Brazil by getting a ticket on an airlines. It's quite an undertaking. He had two daughters. One daughter died young. The other daughter was widowed almost immediately after her marriage. And of course, his wife, enduring all of this and suffering through the addictions of her illustrious but erratic husband, not unexpectedly lost her mind. Now, Yehuda Aryeh was not a man who, despite all of this, was discounted by the rabbinic authorities of the day. He was learned, and he was brilliant. And this particular responsa was not simply the writings of an erratic rabbinic figure, but was in its responsa which was accepted generally by the rabbinic authorities. You'll find it in the great Talmudic encyclopedia of the 18th century, the Pachad Yitzchak. It's quoted and set, in fact, the official line, the official position on this particular area for the synagogue. Now, what's the issue? Rabbinic responsa essentially are documents where a case is presented and then a judicial decision is rendered. In this case, the question is this: is there a place in the synagogue for musical composition? Not is there a place in the synagogue for music? The service had for 1,000 years and more been entirely chanted. But the chant was a simple vocal line, generally a series of notes in a particular pattern which were repeated over and over and over again. There was no such thing as composed music, as deliberate harmonies, as deliberate and intricate musical structure. The Renaissance had seen the development of that kind of music for the Catholic Church. And as you heard this morning, and you recognize this music as having a relationship to medieval church music, or Renaissance church music, there's a question, does such music have any place in the synagogue? The question which was asked of Leon de Modena, the question which begins this text is this, and I'm quoting it. "We have among us some who know the art of music. 6 or 7 knowledgeable young men of our congregation lift up their voices in the synagogue on holidays and festivals and chant the songs and praises, Ein Keloheinu, Aleinu, Yigdal, Adon Olam, and the like, to honor the Lord by orderly arrangement of the voices in accordance with the musical arts." That means in harmony. "There arose a man to drive them out. He said it is not proper to do so, for since the temple was destroyed, rejoicing is forbidden, songs are forbidden, and even praise of God through singing is forbidden. And he argued that they are forbidden based on the verse from the prophet Hosea, Rejoice not, O Israel, among the nations. He made of these singers a mockery in the eyes of the multitude who heard their voice, even though most of them were learned in the Torah. Now let the word come forth from the teachers of the Torah as to whether there is any prohibition in the matter, whether the voice of the objector is right, and whether the voice that is pleasant ought to praise the Lord." Must music be traditional, by whatever terms we define tradition? Now, when a rabbi answers a responsa question put to him, he can't simply, from his own instincts or his own attitudes, give an answer. He must speak out of the tradition itself. The question was not, did Leon de Modena like the new music? Obviously he did. He had organized in Venice one of the first Jewish singing societies that we know of in the medieval world. But the question was there authorization for this kind of music within the rabbinic tradition? Now, the opposition to music was based largely on the fact that we were in exile. We ought to be in mourning. Singing is a form of rejoicing. The text that a man who had tried to drive out the chorus in whatever synagogue this had been, Rejoice not, O Israel, among the nations. Rejoice not, O Israel, when you are among the nations. When you are in Israel, there can be song, there can even be instrumental music. There had been a choir, and there had been an orchestra in the temple in Jerusalem. But now that you are scattered, that you are in exile, music should have no place. And obviously he made a great separation between the traditional simple chants of the synagogue and the kind of structured music, of composed music, which Rossi had and others had begun to set down. Now, how did Leon de Modena, Yehuda Aryeh, answer this question? He answered it by analyzing the term rejoice. Rejoice can mean simply any kind of joy or happiness, or it can mean the idle happiness of an exhibition, the vulgar happiness which comes at a drunken orgy, or it can mean the sacred happiness which comes to a worshiper in the synagogue at prayer. And he agreed with this anonymous man who had tried to drive out to the choir that Israel was forbidden during the exile to engage in vulgar displays of song or of dance which were lascivious or lewd or simply passionate. But when music is in the synagogue, it is something other. There is a tradition in Judaism called the Simcha Shel Mitzvah, the joy of worshiping, the joy of doing God's will. And he reminded in his responsa the readers, those who would read it, that from the very beginning the rabbis had encouraged song in the synagogue. And more than this, that they had made it a positive mitzvah, a positive duty, for instance, at a wedding feast, not only to sing, to dance, but to have violins and other instruments playing. There was the kol sason, the kol simcha, kol chatan, the kol kala, the voice of joy, the voice of rejoicing. And this had always been interpreted to be instrumental music, song, and the like, to make happy the bride and the groom. There were times, in other words, when music, composed music, even instrumental music, was more than appropriate. And synagogue music was one of these. And for his text, he opposed to the text from Hosea, "Rejoice not, O Israel, among the nations," a text from the book of Proverbs, "Kaved et Adonai mechonecha," honor the Lord with your wealth. And he argued that wealth means not simply honoring God with money, with whatever good fortune has been given you, but if you have the blessing of a great voice, that is your wealth, to honor your God with that voice. And if you have the art of composition, that's part of your wealth, to honor your God with harmonies, with the music which is in your soul. And for that reason, he permitted Rossi's composition. He permitted this new kind of music in the synagogue. Which is to say that Rossi's music is not simply interesting music, music which still has appeal, but it was music which for the first time broke with an age-old synagogue tradition of limited chant and introduced the modern music of the synagogue, the music which is composed, music which is more elegant, more intricate, a music which uses the musical language of a particular day in order to express the age-old longings and search and affirmations of our people. So to the tradition, must the music of the synagogue be traditional? Yehuda Aryeh, Leon de Modena, answered, no. We must speak with the language to which our ears are accustomed, and we must listen with the language to which our ears are accustomed. Use the skills of your time in order to beautify the worship of God. And it's true. Just as this Renaissance music seems a bit archaic to us, even as we appreciate its beauty, if we were to listen to the music of the synagogues of the second or third centuries, we would find it so strange, so bizarre, so strange to our ear that we could not truly worship. It was much more high-toned, much more nasal, had very little variety to it. It's the kind of music which we instinctively call Oriental music. And by me saying it, we're saying it's alien to us and to our culture. Now, what is interesting in all of this to a rabbi is the fact that we face this problem again and again in trying to create the kind of atmosphere for worship which is appropriate to a congregation today. What kind of music ought to be the background for our thoughts and for our prayers? I discovered something a long time ago. The first year I came back here to Cleveland from Chicago, I brought with me the score of a setting for this hymn, Avinu Malkeinu, Our Father, Our King, Hear Our Prayer, which we play on the high holidays, on Rosh Hashanah. It was a very beautiful setting which had been written a few years before by a Chicago composer, Max Janowski. He had been my choir director. I'd loved the piece, and I introduced it that first year into the worship of the temple. People responded well to it. 3 years later, Mr. Willard, whom many of you may remember, retired. And our new musical director the next year did not include the Janowski version of Avinu Malkeinu in the service. and I was deluged by angry congregants coming to me and saying, "Where is the traditional music?" Traditional music means simply, I think, the music which we like, the music to which we respond, the music which effectively carries our thoughts upward towards the divine. And so we must always be open to experimentation. The musical idiom of our day is different than the musical idiom of that of our grandfathers, which was Central European and rather Germanic and square in its structure. And each of us must also remember that we are part of a heterogeneous community, and that the music of our childhood may not be the music of the childhood of the person sitting next to us, and therefore may not see, whatever is played may not seem traditional to them. It's very hard to find the music appropriate to a modern congregation, in part because there are so many varieties of musical forms out there, in part because each of us has his own very special musical taste, but most of all because we no longer have totally similar backgrounds. We went to different religious schools. We went to religious school at different times. We come from different kinds of backgrounds. We heard different kinds of music in our home, if we heard Jewish music at all. And so what may be traditional to us may be entirely foreign to the person sitting next to us, and the case can be reversed. But still, we must keep trying, as the psalmist said, I believe, to live up to the idea that we've got to find for our day the music appropriate to it. There's a line in the Psalms which says, "Shir l'Adonai shir chadash," sing unto the Lord a new song. That song is new or ever new, which speaks to us of the heart and from the heart. Now, simply to conclude with Rossi. Rossi is really the first well-known modern Jewish composer. He is the first to actually annotate his compositions, to structure them, to harmonize them, to prepare them for a choir of some 3 to 8 voices. He did not produce a great deal of synagogue music. There is only this one book of the liturgy, 33 different settings. His music was played in the Italian synagogue, which had a different musical tradition than the synagogues of the rest of Europe. Indeed, one of the interesting things about the Italian synagogue is that they pressed the experimentation of music much further than the synagogues north of the Alps. Indeed, within 100 years of Rossi's writing, we find several Italian synagogues actually putting organs into the synagogue. This is now before Reform Judaism. They're putting organs into the synagogue. They will not play them on the Sabbath. That would be work. They will not play them on the high holidays. Again, the prohibition of work. But they will play them on Purim. They will play them on some of the minor festivals of our tradition, where the prescription against work does not apply. North of the Alps, anathemas were hurled against those who did so. And the older cantorial tradition was more or less retained. But the Italians, within the context of orthodoxy, within the context of tradition, had found the elbow room with which to bring in what was for their day, the new music into the synagogue. And they began the long tradition, which we are beginning to develop, which we are continuing to develop in our own day. If you want to see attend one of the great glories of our modern synagogue musical tradition, and this is what's called in the trade a plug, it's coming Friday night. Our choir, 25 or more voices strong, will be on the pulpit of the main temple for a musical evening with the service of Darius Milhaud. It's the 10th anniversary of Milhaud's death. He, like Rossi, he was a composer. Most of his work was in the secular, the non-Jewish field. But he composed one great Sabbath service, a setting for the Sabbath service. And our choir will present it to you. Mel Hakala, who many of you will remember, and because you hear him every year at the high holidays, will be the lead singer. And Darius Milhaud's wife will be our honored guest at the service. So from Rossi to Milo to this morning, we deal with a serious question, an unresolved question. What music shall we play? What music do we delight to hear? And if you would like to be part of the solution, rather than simply listening to the rabbi state the problem for you, I invite you to join the music committee of the temple, which has these responsibilities for our worship. Amen.